did it happen? So the answer is Vayhi b'mei Achashverosh. Fixing the time of the events, all those events which Megillah is about to narrate happened in the time of Achashverosh. Second, Igeres is more than a tale at a higher level, more than a descriptive chronicle recording dry facts, naked, isolated events in chronological order. It's more than that. Igeres, at the second level, contains not just a story, but a living history. At the first level, that of description and observation, Igeres is just a story. It's not history as yet. At the second level, Igeres becomes history, and history is living. Igeres, at the higher level, is not only informing, as it is at the first level, but interpreting as well. It addresses itself at the second level, not only to the platitudinous, fact-prying, gossip-enjoying, excuse the colloquialism, nosy instinct, but to our knowledge-questing, inquisitive mind as well. Of course, Igeres, even at this level, does narrate, certainly. Yet its main task is to explain, not only to tell a story. Igeres at that level not only describes, but also interprets. It links up events, sets them up against their proper causal background, and points out their fundamental patterns of development. In short, at this stage, Igeres is not a descriptive chronicle or story, but interpretive history. Our rabbi said, Gemara Megillah, Nikra Sigeres, Shimhitil Boshlei Shechutim Ksheiro. The scrolls must be held together by stitches. Three at least. Of course, the stitches symbolize the unity of the tale, the causative unfolding of the events, interpretation. At this level, the idea of emet, truth, with which the Igeres at its higher level, as I said before, must comply, is related to interpretation rather than to observation, as we have explained before. It is a truth achieved not just through careful, cautious observation, but through correct thinking, profound analysis, and thorough understanding of events. By simply listening to the heartbeat of history, it is the kind of truth which is binding not on the witness, as the case was before, but on the dayan, on the judge, who in contrast to the aid, to the witness, is interested in the causal nexus of events, in motivation, interrelatedness, and interaction. The truth in this context is not descriptive, not matter of fact, but inventive, and I would say creative. What is safer vis-à-vis Egeres? Safer in contradistinction to Egeres at both levels signifies certainly a book. But when the Gemara says safer, the Gemara had something else in mind. It's not just a book, but a book written under the impact of divine inspiration, under the impact and influence of Ruach HaKodesh. It's a prophetic book. Sefer, as an inspired book, is not interested in a story, nor is it concerned even with history. If history be understood as the science of individual events, as the science of one-timely occurrences that took place once and vanished into oblivion. Sefer, if it's a part of the Kisvei HaKodesh, of the canon, is concerned not with individual events, but with universality, whose truth is not limited to a single epoch or particular set of circumstances that will hardly repeat itself. As I said before, for the safer, history ceases to be a science of the individual, particular, single event and becomes the metaphysique of the universal, general, symbolic, the constant and the perpetual law. Events for the Sefer, for the Chronicle, they are events. For the Sefer, they turn into symbols. For the Chronicle, historical figures, the actors in the historical drama, are people that live and die. For the Sefer, historical figures that lived once upon a time become archetypes or prototypes whose image is stamped time and again upon all those who emerge in the historical arena. Thus, the Sefer does not tell us the story of yesteryear of an individual who lived and died long, long ago, or of a community of a certain day and age, but Sefer tells us the perennial, old new story of human destiny in general and Jewish destiny in particular. Sefer moves events from the particular, from the transient and the one-timely toward the universal, steady, omnipresent and dynamic in the great drama of human destiny. At this point, the idea of truth transcends that of factual observation as well as that of causalistic interpretation and reaches at the level of the Sefer into the realm of inspiration. Truth at this stage is of a predictive nature. To be truthful means to be inspired, to enjoy clairvoyance, to see in every individual fact the fingerprints of universality in each passing phenomenon, to see in each passing phenomenon what a certain historian Rankes called once, the trends of the centuries and the traces of the millennia. The Sefer sees in every individual fact the reflection of the internal, of the inevitable, and in each plot, the manifestation of the elan vital of human and Jewish destiny. The truth of the Sefer is revealed, not discovered, beheld as a vision, not just inferred by logical judgment. נאום הגבר שמי האמרי קהל, אך שמח הזה שדה היחד זה נפל וגלו אינויים. Word of the man whose eye is true. In short, Megillas Esther as a Sefer is a part of the Sefer HaSfarim, of the canon of the Tisri HaKedesh. It is, I would say, an halachic book. Maimonides expressed himself, Arihi Kayemes, the scroll of Esther, will be as permanent, Kechamisho Chum Sheteiro, like the five books of Moses, and like the statues of Torah Shebal Peh. It's an halachic book, replete with rules, principles and criteria which should guide us as human beings and as Jews. And tonight, when I gave my topic or the theme of my address, I did not foresee the difficulties which I'll encounter in writing this paper. But once I said, I had to implement my promise. Tonight I wish to analyze just a few ideas which are relevant to our present involvement in the contemporary historical struggle. The Jews are now involved in a strange manner in the struggle between the two titans, the East and the West, two systems of government, two societies, two communities, two philosophies. I would like to try tonight to interpret our unique position, and in particular, and the struggle and the clash between the two titans in general, in terms of Megillas Esther, to study contemporary events in biblical and halachic categories. And I warn you, there is a subtle analysis. I wish you would pay attention later to it. You think, how do I know it's subtle? Perhaps it's bad. So you'll be the judges later. Let us just get a glimpse first, before we get involved in metaphysics, into the story of Esther. The story of Esther tells us in the most lively fashion, with a tinge of refined yet biting sarcasm, about paradoxical events. And forgive me again the use of the colloquialism, I would say crazy events. It's the best description, which are both tragic and comical at the same time. We are told a story about or of a king who, as our rabbis, Chazal have already remarked sarcastically, kill this beautiful, beloved young queen. It's quite possible she was his bride. At the suggestion, of a friend, Memuchon. It's quite possible that Memuchon was Homon, the same person. And later, a short time later, hanged his best friend, or the same friend, who in the meantime succeeded to rise to the top of the Persian hierarchy upon the complaint of his beautiful queen and bride Esther. It is a strange story, which is bold, as I said before, sad and funny, about a king per se neither wicked nor cruel. Chazal say he was not too intelligent. But a story about a king who signed upon the spur of the moment a decree, an edict, to exterminate a people whose identity he did not know, and about a people, to destroy a people, about whom he simply did not make in any inquiry. And a short time later, forgot the whole incident, became very indignant. Then Esther told him what the content of the edict was. It is a story about a commonwealth where many races lived, many languages were spoken, many rituals and cults practiced. It is a story about a pluralistic society, there is no doubt about it, culturally, religiously, which suddenly decided to commit genocide for one reason only. The people who were to be exterminated, who were abiding by the religious statutes and laws that differed from those of other people. Something else is puzzling. It is almost frightening. It is a story about millions and millions of people, among whom there were certainly countless liberal-minded, decent individuals who accepted the satanic, bloodthirsty, murderous royal edict indifferently in cold blood. It's a story about a conspiracy of silence agreed to by the entire population of the great Persian Empire. No one interfered. And mind you, it's very simple. It was permissible to demonstrate in Shushan. Not were afraid. I have the proof that it was permissible. It's quite obvious. Mordechai did parade in the streets of the capital wrapped in sackcloth with ashes on his head, and he cried with a bitter and loud cry. Mordechai even demonstrated in front of the royal palace. No guard blocked his way, yet no one else joined him. Neither friend, he certainly had many friends, nor stranger. Where Shushan Avecha, the city of Shushan, was perplexed. The Jews did not believe. They refused to face reality. The non-Jew did not care. Period. Moreover, The story is puzzling from another viewpoint, because of a very strange coincidence. A short time before, the entire population was invited to the seven-day feast on the grounds of the royal palace. The invitations were extended to everybody, without a single exception, Jew and Gentile alike, to all races, faith, because the Megillah states in unmistakable terms, Lecholom Animtziim b'Shushan Abiro, and to all the people who were present in Shushan. They, of course, as guests of the king, fraternized, drank toast, shook hands, and hugged each other. And a little later, the ruthless, inhuman edict was issued and sent hastily with the couriers to all parts of the commonwealth, lehashmid, leharig, ulehabit, to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day. And the question, rises spontaneously, how was it possible, we ask ourselves, that the same friends just a week ago or 2 weeks ago, before, shook hands with them, and paid compliments to each other, and drank together, and ate together, and feasted together, should not raise their voice in protest? There is a very cryptic remark in the Megillah. Orotzim yotzutrufim bidvar ha-melech ve'ados nitno b'shushan abiro ha-melech ve'homon yoshu lishteis v'yoshushan ha-recho. The post went forth in haste, and the decree was given out in Shushan, and the king in Haman sat down to drink, and the city of Shushan was bewildered. Not in grief, as some translations render it. Navecha means bewildered. The king and Haman celebrated. What? I don't know. You can tell me, I would be grateful to you. By feasting on the wine, I read somewhere, I don't remember where at all, that the dignitaries of the Nazi party, after they had completed their work on the famous Weissensee document dealing with the final solution of the Judenfrage, feasted until dawn on Frankfurt and beer. Achashverus liked to wine, they like beer. They were Germans. I believe that many questions rise, and I don't have to enumerate them. And I also believe the same questions are applicable to a more recent event, to a more recent epoch. It's almost a replica of what the Megillah tells us. There's one difference only. As far as the story of 2500 years ago is concerned, it was just a conspiracy which has never been implemented. In the 40s, it was not just a conspiracy. It was a reality. I don't like to complain. I don't like to ask for justice. I don't like to simply to tell the world, how cynically it acted. I would like tonight, as Spinoza said, not to cry, neither to cry nor to laugh, neither to criticize, nor to approve or to condone, but simply just understand. And here we are coming to a metaphysical analysis of man. I would like you to listen carefully. The answer to that riddle can be found in our philosophy of man as a dual dichotomous being, burdened with an inner contradiction, an intrinsic conflict. It's within him, I said it on another occasion, but it wouldn't do harm, I mean, to repeat it. Yahadus, Judaism, has never accepted the so-called two-valued logic developed by Aristotle, whose foundation is the principle of contradiction and also the principle of the excluded middle. And Aristotle, in all simplicity, and our Greek can afford to be simple, we can't afford. We are complex natures. As that, if there is A and B, and A contradicts B, so either A is wrong or B is wrong. Both cannot be right. I said that quite often in the halachic realm, I'm simply speaking now about halachic concepts, we ignore the Aristotelian principle as modern physics does today as well, in the field of nuclear physics. Both principles by Aristotle have been not abandoned but completely suspended, if necessary. The principle of contradiction and the principle of the excluded middle. The halacha has known that secret for a long time. And the halacha many times accepts both A and B, even though A and B are mutually exclusive. The halacha believes that dovor v'ifuchei, both can be true. That there is a possibility for a contradictio in the adjecto or objecto to be true without negating the truth of the opposite statement. I could prove it to you on purely halachic grounds if I had more time tonight. Don't get scared, I'm not right. However, in the halacha it is true, but not fundamental, not basic. We could get along in the halacha even with the Aristotelian principle, even accepting the principle of contradiction and that of the excluded middle. In Jewish philosophy, it would be impossible simply to understand or to comprehend the very essence of our world outlook, of our Weltanschauung, without abandoning or eliminating the Aristotelian principle or the Aristotelian two-valued logic. Let us now, pay our attention to man. Halacha had a dialectical approach to man. There is a thesis, and there is an antithesis. On the one hand, Yahadus looked upon man with a sympathetic, appreciative eye. Indeed, I would say with admiration. Could you tell me whether the term admiration is the proper context? Did Yahadus admire man or didn't he? What do you say about it? I said admiration. Should have stopped me, perhaps. Is there a manifestation of admiration and great, profound respect for man? Of course there is. I believe it is in Psalm? Psalm Chesed, not, 8. It's 8, or perhaps I make a mistake. Ches. Kills vat chasrei umeat melekim. וכובד ועודו תיאטריו. He's just, he's one bit lower than the angels, and he's surrounded with dignity and majesty. Yehadus has time and again expressed faith in man. Not only Yehadus has admired man, has also expressed faith in man, and believed in the human uniqueness, in his royal status in nature, in his contemplative, meditative powers. After all, Yehadus said, he is the only rational being in the universe. Perhaps you'll find some, on a distant star, who will go like that. That this thesis that Yehadus had a sympathetic, optimistic approach to man is correct can be attested by something else, proven by something else. And I believe this proof is incontrovertible. The fact that Yehadus has granted man moral freedom, but complete, unrestricted, unqualified moral freedom. The human being enjoys unrestricted moral freedom. God does not want to interfere with man's liberty to plot his own existential course. Apparently, man is deserving of freedom. Were man undeserving of freedom, he wouldn't have received that grant, the most precious of gifts, which God had bestowed upon people, upon the human being, upon the world, upon creation. It has not been granted to any other future. And moral freedom, according to the Rambam, to Maimonides, is a tenet of our faith. In spite of the fact that he has not included moral freedom among the Shleish Esrei, the 13 articles of faith. On the other hand, Yehadus has treated man with extreme caution, I would say even suspicion. The reason for the Judaic skepticism concerning man is due to our historical experience and our long memory that have been hunting the Jews since time immemorial. Namely, the experience and the memory that man who is endowed with divine rationality may turn at a moment's notice into either a non-rational or even an irrational being. And therefore, Yehadus took all extravaganza of man in stride. Was never too much impressed when man did go berserk. It was never stunned, amazed, or taken aback watching the latter man suddenly run amok. There is, in the opinion of Yehadus, no element of surprise in man's abrupt changes and unpredictable transformations. His unpredictability is a part of his humanity And I would say his unpredictability is predictable. I've just said that man either turns, man is a rational being, but he, quite often, frequently, man turns into either a non-rational or an irrational being. So let me now analyze it and hear the analysis begins. It means that man has three alternatives, three options. Either can be a rational being, or it can be a non-rational being, hyphenated, of course. And if he wants, he can even become an irrational being. What do these three alternatives represent? Rationality, non-rationality, and irrationality. In order to understand exactly what is meant under non-rationality in contradistinction to irrationality, we must inquire into the source of the threefold schism in the human personality. We may ask what causes the threefold split, the triple conflict and feud within him. What lies at the root? Limited being. He is burdened with finiteness. He is a finite being. And he is aware of it. He is simply burdened with finiteness awareness, or he himself experiences his finiteness. It's not something which has got to be told to him that you are a finite being, a restricted being, a limited being. He knows it, if he wants to know the truth, that he is finite. It's an awareness. He experiences, existentially, metaphysically, his incompleteness and imperfection, his closeness to nothingness. He knows that his power is restricted, knowledge nil, vigor ebbing with age, his years are numbered, successes few, frustrations many, and in general, his existential prospects are bleak at best. Per se, it is a metaphysical awareness. It's not a psychological awareness. It is a metaphysical, it's an existential awareness. It's a part of the greater awareness of that if I exist. I exist as a limited being. I exist as a finite creature. I exist as an imperfect and incomplete being. However, this metaphysical awareness, this existential awareness, it's not psychological. Like our consciousness of we exist is not a psychological one. It's much deeper. It lies at the very root of the human psyche. The human psyche may express that awareness of I exist. But if what the I exist is the very root of our mentality and our psychological constitution. However, this knowledge, even though metaphysical, finds its expression also in psychological experiences, in disordered moods, in manly being dissatisfied with himself, disenchanted with the world, and who is not disenchanted with others, with themselves, fools are not dissatisfied. In being angry with everybody, including himself, it expresses itself in the restlessness of the young. I mean not the American of 1969-70 brand. I mean old-fashioned restlessness of the young. It's not something which you have discovered. I was also restless as a young boy, but I expressed it in a different fashion. I might say in a more dignified fashion. But there was dissatisfaction, there was rebellion, there was insurrection in me. In the restlessness, I don't know whether we do it now, but girls used to do it. We locked themselves suddenly up in a room, buried their head in pillows and cried for no reason to justify that mood. This knowledge of finiteness, of imperfection and incompleteness finds, as I said, its expression and manifestation in young boys disapproving of their parents, young boys hating Pa and being contemptuous of Ma, and parading and striking and demonstrating. It finds its expression in the loneliness and desolation of the elderly, and then also in the fear of the middle age, who are about to become old, to get old. There are no reasons, if you investigate all those moods, and they are passing moods, but nevertheless real, you would not discover the theology, so to say, or the causal background of such moods. Because they reach much deeper, they go back to the awareness, the I exist awareness, which is both affirming and negating man. I exist, yes, affirming, but at the same time, I exist as an imperfect being, as an incomplete being. All those moods, all those experiences we call psychological experiences reflect the fundamental awareness of man of being incomplete, finite, and therefore considers his existence unwarranted and unjustified. I know what many of you think now. I'm a pretty good mind reader. I mean, as far as my pupils are concerned, Rabbi Soloveitchik has become an existentialist. True or false, I don't know, perhaps I am. But I'll tell you, if I am an existentialist, I'm not of the Sartre or Heidegger or Jaspers brand. I'm of a much older brand. You know of whose? Of Sefer Tehillim, of the books of Sartre. If there was an existentialist, and the greatest of all, was it the psalmist. And he spoke about the finiteness awareness, the awareness of incompletion, of incompleteness rather, and imperfection. What name did he coin for that awareness? Not such a fancy name as finiteness. I don't know whether the term is grammatically correct. But however, what name did he coin for that? No? Right? The Sami speaks about Mima Makim Krosicho Adishem. The depth, the profundis, out of which his cry rises to heaven. He also speaks about Mina Meitzar Korosiko, from the straits, of course straits are narrow, but from existential narrowness, Korosiko. What are those Manamakim? What are they? The depth, the profundis, out of which his cry rises to heaven. He also speaks about Mina Meitzar Korosiko, from the straits, of course straits are narrow, but from existential narrowness, Korosiko. What are those Manamakim? What are they? Not peace. What is that Mina Meitzar? What kind of straits are they? Of course, what are those Mina Makim? What is that Mina Meitzar, if not the experience of finiteness or metaphysical distress which abides in man? Interestingly, the Zohar speaks of 10 ma'amakim, 10 aspects of the human awareness of incompleteness. Of course, I'll speak later about our halachic approach to the problem of the finiteness awareness, the problem of mamakim. By the way, you wouldn't find it in Erev. But there is an halachic interpretation and also a solution to the problem. Because as I'll explain to you later, we Jews have accepted that. We've never rebelled against it. Mother man, when I say mother man, perhaps the word mother is not fitting, because it goes back to the Greeks of old. The tradition which, it's an old tradition which mother man has accepted as the point of departure for his world outlook in Weltanschauung. Mother man rejects the finiteness awareness. He does not look upon himself as if he were engulfed in ma'amakim. He does not look upon himself as if he were, so to say, in the straits. All exits sealed. No one to help him to get to land, or to get his freedom. Mother man wants to be more than he is in reality. He attempts to overreach himself. He wants to achieve vastness, boundlessness. He resents boundaries in general. He wants to disobey stop signs and to rush toward infinity. Particularly, mother man hates defeat. He cannot take defeat. Neither the individual nor the community can take defeat. Can our country take defeat in Vietnam? It can't. And when people storm the gates of the White House, they don't understand that it's humanly impossible to take defeat. Defeat is imposed upon a human being. He never accepts it voluntarily. And that's why America cannot just get out of Vietnam. It's not a political statement, it's a metaphysical statement. So discuss. As I said before, he hates defeat, and particularly he hates, not only hates, he's horrified by the prospect of meeting with defeat in death. He hates death. In this welter of frustrating feelings, anxieties and fears, all of them revolving around finiteness of man in terms of time, around his final destiny, about the absurdity of living, while knowing that one is headed toward the grave, which puts an end to all human inspirations, visions and commitments, it becomes necessary for modern man to reach for salvation, some salvation. No matter how illusory, no matter how short-lived, and no matter how deceitful. In fact, all experiments to cure man, not of measles, but of his metaphysical awareness of finiteness, of his fear of death, are simply absurd, because he never can be cured of death. But modern man wants to cure himself. He wants to redeem himself without appealing to God for redemption, for salvation. Of course, and I wish to stay there. Of course, that modern man tries to defeat death scientifically, through medicine, this is praiseworthy. Iadus has always approved of scientific medicine. Iadus has never faced the problem which Christianity did. How is one allowed for me to cure himself? Christianity still has not overcome this difficulty. Yehadus has accepted medicine, the scientific art of healing, as something natural and indispensable. I am speaking now about men trying to forget about his finiteness through a way of life. Two paths are open to frightened man, and man is a frightened being. Mother man more frightened than men of old, to frightened man. It's interesting that the point of departure is the same, yet the path leads to opposite objectives. The point of departure is a simple one. The death experience, or the fear of nothingness, or you may say, the finiteness awareness, as the psalmist calls it, mimamaki, is inextricably intertwined with the I exist awareness. one has to pass through the light of the existential awareness, of the I exist awareness, in order to get to the chilling darkness of non-being, of the grave. If one could stay forever in the beneficent twilight of a non-reflective, please listen carefully, of a non-reflective, matter-of-fact being, without soul-searching, without meditating, without trying to equate being with knowing, and without subscribing to the old idea that real is only who knows himself to be real. If man could do it, in other words, if one could suspend or at least dim, obscure, the I exist awareness, he would not have to be burdened with the fear of death or the finiteness awareness or the awareness of imperfection or incompleteness. But the question rose immediately, how can one suspend or at least eclipse a bit the I exist awareness? Because when a man enjoys his being, his existence, then he begins to think of the opposite destiny of his. The answer was, first, by abandoning the moral norm which is implied in the finite I exist awareness. In the finite I exist awareness, there is a moral norm. I exist for a certain time, for a very short time. My span of life is limited, and I am burdened with a task which I have to accomplish during that short span of life. In the I exist, there is another awareness implied. I exist, and I am duty-bound to utilize or take advantage of my existence, to make my contribution. I'll speak later about it. Yes. There is a moral norm. The moral law is intuitively implied in the I exist awareness. I crossed this valley only once, and while I'm on my journey for this world, I should leave my mark, and I should leave traces. I should accomplish something. So first of all, if one wants to abandon the moral norm implied in the I exist awareness, then he'll dim the awareness. The awareness will not be as intense and as overpowering. But how do you abandon the moral norm? It's simply by intoxication or drunkenness. I don't mean intoxication with alcohol or drunkenness, with whiskey, but actually by intoxicating oneself, by the rapturous, hypnotic, hedonic experience. You know what hedonia is, what pleasure experience. Not as nice as hedonia. Which overpowers man and which takes him out of the world of flowing time, of prospection and anticipation. For orgiastic man, time is reduced to one dimension, the present moment. Of course, the obscuration of the I exist awareness and the surrender to hedonism, which is exciting and perplexing, is a result in the loss of rationality. Man is disciplined, courageous, and resent deceit. He wants to stay in the illumined path, even though by enjoying the dazzling light, will have to cast a glance into the yawning abyss of horrors. Rational man does not escape from reality, notwithstanding the fact, the unpleasant fact, that the reality he must encounter, the final reality he must encounter, is death. Rational man experiences being as a normative moral affair. I exist in order to accomplish. Orgiastic man forms the aesthetic society, the orgiastic society, whose prime objective is to enjoy and not to be aware either of being or non-being. The hedonic society is non-reflective, non-meditating, non-introspective, non-self-appraising, or self-searching. The hedonic society is more or less a democratic society. This is the Western society. In pursuit of pleasure and happiness. And that society, if you want simply to break down its world philosophy, its world outlook, its Weltanschauung into its component part. So this democratic society is in pursuit of pleasure, insists on minimum government interference in private life, true, resents controls, demands unrestricted freedom in matters which don't affect the community, particularly, it is true, particularly matters of sex morality, hates discipline imposed from above, not even by teachers, is opposed to any draft, to any conscription, and does not like to pay high taxes. The motto of the orgiastic society, or call it as hedonic, if you have mercy on the society. I call it orgiastic society, because our society is orgiastic in manner. The orgiastic society, the motto of the orgiastic society was formulated long ago. How long ago, would you say? How long ago? In Kol Chodesh Tachas HaShemesh. The Yippies and the Hippies did not discover anything. How long ago, what do you say? Huh? Since when? Of course they're Doramabul. It's almost antediluvian. Vayiru b'nei olekim es b'nei sorodom kitei veiseino vayikhu lahem noshim mekeila asher bachoru. And the sons of the mighty, so the daughters of men, they are fair, and they took them to wives, whomsoever they chose. What should be emphasized, underlined in that statement, in that verse? What would you underline? Of course, the Mekela Shabachoru. What the Torah underlines is the phrase, not the liked fair woman. This itself wouldn't be so bad. for the freedom from any normative system interfering with human hedonism. No authority, this worldly or transcendental, may legislate how men should enjoy life. As long, of course, that they'll admit, as long as it does not infringe upon the rights of others. Orgiastic man does not only respond willfully, enthusiastically, to inevitable biological urges. This wouldn't be bad. Whose fulfillment yields pleasure, but experiments with the idea and how to precipitate new pressures and unheard of, newly contrived artificial situations which should challenge the body to respond by engaging in gratifying action which is completely unnecessary. In short, our Western society is the typical representative of the aesthetic society, which actually originated, the real founder of the aesthetic society. Who is the real founder? You speak about founding fathers. Who is the, here it happens to be a founding mother. No? Who is she? Chava, of course. Vatero isho keteva eitz vamacho, vichitavo hiro enoim, venech mozei eitz vahaskil, vatikach mitpirye va... Vatechal. In that moment, Western society was founded and incorporated. Actually, the one who took the charter out for the hedonic society was Eve. To tell you that the Torah hated orgiastic men, not only resented, hated, abhorred, is unnecessary. And the censure or the rebuke against orgiastic men or hedonic society was formulated in the Torah where? Where? Where you say? No. That side. No. People sit on my right. I mean, I believe the rebuke or hedonic life was censured in the 10th commandment. Thou shalt not covet, shalt not desire something which is beyond your reach. One must not stretch out his hand, for sense infinity, spiritual infinity is great, sense infinity is corrupting and abominable. For carnal boundlessness, for the vastness that the flesh demands of man. The Torah did condone a pleasant, happy and gracious life, provided that enjoyment is bounded and the call of the blood is moderated. One may pursue pleasure according to our viewpoint if he knows how and when to retreat and withdraw. How many times did the Torah, how many times did hedonic society come to the foreground, to the surface, as far as the accounts of the Pentateuch are concerned. How many times had the Pentateuch recorded the emergence of hedonic society into the historical biblical arena? How many times? I believe four times. Orgiastic men appeared, and God, who is patient and kind and benevolent, punished him severely. Of course, the first was Eve. The second, of course, the orgiastic society, orgiastic men of Deir Hamabul. Now the third, where is the third? Huh? I can't hear you. Sdom, Sdom was about Sdom we'll speak later. They deserve special attention. I don't believe that Sdom belongs to the group, the Sdom society was orgiastic or perhaps, but not. Ah? Kibrotatavo. The people in the desert, when they shouted and demanded flesh, meat, quail, they were overcome by lust. And the wind from the Lord started up, swept quail from the sea, and threw them over the camp. And the people sat together in quail all the day and night. The meat was still between their teeth when the anger of the Lord blazed forth. And finally, a fourth time, the famous Baal Pe'er episode by Yochel Om Lisneis as Bnei's mayor, the people began to commit adultery with the Moabite women. And now I wish to emphasize something. When I speak of orgiastic men or the hedonic society, I'm not referring exclusively to carnal hedone, to real hedone of the flesh, like gluttony or promiscuity. I don't refer it exclusively. I don't refer to what is known in medieval scholastics, and I always find it hard to pronounce, as concupiscence. You know what it is? I don't. It's lust, more or less it's lust. It's more or less it's something very bad anyway. As a matter of fact, and let us be truthful, Western world is addicted to this strange, let me see again, concupiscence. Western world is lusty, is in pursuit for pleasures of the flesh. The whole sex morality, so-called sex morality, of the campuses, I mean, can attest to what I say. Western world is addicted to this kind of hedonism. Many European, and I may say, I mean, not my patriotism should not, I'm a patriot, but an American, but many European, particularly Scandinavian countries, have reached absolute proportion in their liberality and legislation pertaining to sex morals or sex habits. However, when I say hedonei, and this is true even in the old, in the sense of the Greek term, when I say hedonei, I refer to human questing for all goods of the senses. If the element of boundlessness or the drive for infinity, for vastness, or the element of overreaching oneself, of trying to grab more than I can consume, is present. Whenever the fantasy, because it's an aesthetic experience, it's also an experience, a fantastic experience. Whenever the fantasy begins to stimulate man and to stir in him unqualified yearning for the finite goods of sense, they are good, but are finite, and they are not goods of the spirit, they are goods of the sense. Be it money, be it large estate, be it lust, sex lust, be it delicious food, be it social prominence, the so-called publicity. Wherever desire, unlimited desire, rises, orgiastic man emerges into the arena. Even the miser, kind of a miser described by Gogol, whatever, who keeps on piling up golden coins without spending a nickel on himself, starving, dressed in rags, is also, in a funny way, orgiastic. He belongs also to the hedonic society. For he cannot satiate his hunger for gold. And if there is no satiety, then man is orgiastic. Whether orgiastic man is industrialist, or banker, or a Casanova, or Napoleon, or even a great scientist, doesn't matter. What is important? That their imagination weaves a halo around goods, finite, a halo of infinity, around finite goods of sense. And they find, they are mistaken, but they think they have found self-fulfillment in finite goods of sense. And tell me now, isn't the Western society, the hedonic society, who tries to find self-fulfillment in the finite goods of sense? There is another society, because there's another path, I told you, which human beings take in order to escape from the finiteness awareness, in order to engage in self-deceit, not only in an illusion, but simply in a delusion. The second path, along which frightened man, mother man, travels in his wild flight from finiteness, death leads, as I have said before, in the opposite direction. instead of dimming, while orgiastic man dims his awareness, his I exist, and I must accomplish awareness. Instead of dimming the I exist awareness and surrendering to sensuous rapture of living, men attempt to enhance and to exalt his I exist awareness. Men at this stage, traveling along the second path, tries to overcome the fear of finiteness through a big lie. You know, the method of the big lie was initiated, you know, by Goebbels, taken over by Khrushchev, transmitted to people in Sinai, I'm sorry, Yeshua, transmitted to Brezhnev, and little by little handed down to Western society as well. Through the big lie, through convincing himself that he is more than man, through intentionally magnifying 100-fold and exaggerating and lying about human ability and power to solve both scientific and metaphysical problems of humanity, by simply painting in iridescent colors in the eschatological age, which will be brought about by man alone through his wisdom and creative effort. I believe that you know what I'm referring to. In a word, man wants to defeat, who travels along the second path, wants to defeat his anxiety concerning death, his finiteness, through setting himself up as a deity, powerful, wise, and creative. The awareness, I exist, expanding to a larger awareness, I do exist as creator, as mighty ruler, legislator, and final authority. And something happens. I mean, whoever, of course, I mean, that this method has been employed by all humanists. I mean, those humanists who wanted to replace transcendental morality with man-made morality. It's certainly true of the Marxist world outlook. It's to say that the Marxism has taken an optimistic approach to man does not suffice. They adore man. Not only admire, but adore. And they not only idealize man, but they idolize man. And by idolizing man, setting him up as a deity, no wonder that there is simple, that a certain idolatrous cult develops there from time to time, like the cult of Lenin, I mean of Stalin, the present cult of Lenin, the cult of Mao Zedong, and so forth and so on. I mean, because basically, fundamentally, they try to overcome human finiteness, human imperfection, by idolizing themselves. Of course, if I call, I mean, it was hard to find the proper term how to describe that man. I call him arrogant man, I believe it's good. Arrogant man who wants to erase his finiteness experience through self-idolization, his attention, he must shift his attention from the individual to the society, from the single person to the group, to mankind, because to idolize the individual would be nonsensical, would be absurd. The latter, society, mankind, humanity, is idolized, deified, and set up as the omnipotent deity. For humanity as such, no single individual, will, in the opinion of self-sufficient, arrogant man, redeem itself from bondage. Only mankind itself can accomplish, can liberate itself. The idol is the class, not the individual. Of course, the individual who is idolized is the image of the class. He is, so to say, the substitute for the class. He represents the class. But through Lenin, through Mao Zedong, and through Stalin, the class was idolized. This arrogant society is unfortunately not pleasure sick. Oh no, not at all. On the contrary, an ascetic streak runs through this society. In the name of some doctrine or code, man-made of course, they appeal for sacrifices. They are norm conscience, in contradistinction to Western man, who abandoned norms. They are norm conscious and duty-oriented. Western man has forgotten what duty means. In the name of a doctrine, on behalf of an ethical code, which was legislated by man, they are out to conquer or destroy the world. There is no third option to them. There is no third alternative. The human-made norm is ultimate. Every human-formulated doctrine becomes a credo, an article of faith, whose cogency must not be doubted, and woe to the writer who doubts the absolute cogency and veracity of a Marxist doctrine. So, in other words, arrogant man becomes a tyrant. And the society turns, an arrogant society that he establishes, turns it into a tyrannical society. The tyrannical, arrogant society is bold and aggressive, trampling upon individual freedom and personal dignity. The arrogant society scoffs at human faith in God and considers faith in a transcendental existence as a human weakness. Arrogant man is well organized, disciplined. Their undertakings are bold in design and daring in execution. Did such a society exist? In Bible, of course, the day of love, of course. This is arrogant, tyrannical society was portrayed in Chumash by the day of love. It's a very strange generation it was. Let me just read two verses from the Chumash. And they said to one another, come, let us make brick and burned them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime for mortar. And they said, come, let us build a city and a tower with its top in heaven. It is hard sometimes to identify whose words we just read. Are they the words spoken by fanatical, vainglorious men of old, of antiquity, or by some communist leader of today? Arrogant men, while orgiastic man is non-rational, arrogant man is irrational. Why? Why? And I want you to understand, non-rational man means simply a man who simply has cast off, shed his rationality. Irrational man means a man who has a rationality, but a funny one. Irrationality is very rational, I want you to know. There is reasonableness to irrationality. There is no reasonableness to non-rationality. But there is system, there is continuity, there is unity, there is consistency to irrationality. Non-rational man rejects norms. Non-rational man is basically an agnostic. He refuses to accept a transcendent law. However, he knows well that the norm legislated by him is of no value, is relative. Non-rational man is not destructive. He's not satanic. He's not that.